This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions changed their careers, what relationships influenced their work. My guest today is actress and comedian Sandra Bernhardt. Her father was a proctologist and her mother an abstract artist, and that combination formed her worldview. For many, Sandra Bernhardt is a comedian, and she began her career at comedy clubs in L.A. in the 1970s. Soon, she caught the attention of the likes of Paul Mooney, who became a comedy mentor. She calls herself a postmodern entertainer, but you should never underestimate Sandra Bernhardt's career as a legit actress. In her 1983 breakout role in Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy, Bernhardt held her own opposite Robert De Niro and Jerry Lewis. Bernhardt says she never wanted to settle for just telling jokes. She always wanted more, a bigger stage, a louder voice, a wider audience. Born in Flint, Michigan, Sandra Bernhardt was raised in a conservative Jewish family. She moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, and spent 8 months on a kibbutz out of high school. She moved to L.A. in 1974 at age 19 and enrolled in beauty school.
My entire higher education cost $340. My dad wrote a check and left town. I was like, you got off easy, my dear dad. And then I was on my own. I got a couple of jobs, and then I landed on my feet at 351 North Cannon Drive at CIA Hair Salon. That was the name of one of the hair guys who owned the salon. And I was there for 5.5 years. And I a year later, I started performing at night at clubs.
What was the Jewish identity thing for you? You growing up in Flint and you moved to Scottsdale. You're how old?
10.
And you grew up in a very conservative Jewish household.
Yes.
So was it understood you'd go do the kibbutz thing at some point and go to Israel for
some point? No. I just had tons of family who, when they left Russia, they went to Israel and we came to America. So my brothers had all gone to work on kibbutzim. And in the 70s, it was a great fun thing to do after high school. And they welcomed everybody's, you know, help, and they didn't pay you anything, but they fed you and clothed you.
And what did you do? What were you doing?
I did several things. I worked picking grapefruits and oranges, and then my main job was working in the slaughterhouse. It's called the Mashcheta, and I was on the line, the assembly line. The chickens come down. Everybody took out different parts. My main thing was pulling out the lungs, actually. I vacuumed lungs out of chickens. I know, you look at me
8 months of that.
Yeah.
Picking fruit.
Yeah.
Something very clean and wholesome and sweet, and then ripping the lungs out of, vacuuming the lungs out of the chickens.
Well, you just did what they asked you to do. And if that was something that was, you know, not comfortable for you, they wouldn't force you to do it. You work like from 7 to like 12, and then you have the afternoons off, and you stay up late and hang out with all the other, you know, kids from all over the world, and you get to know people and have fun. And, you know, it was like an international experience. It was incredible.
You were working yourself to death.
No.
Because you're one of the great kvelers of all time in my mind, and I get to see you turning to somebody going, how much longer am I gonna have to vacuum out these lungs?
I mean, I never complained. I'm a worker. I like to work, and when I have to do it, I do it. I like manual labor.
You do?
Yeah, I like to clean. I like to do laundry. I like to wash dishes. So if everything, the bottom fell out, I'd be fine.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think you like? I'm taking you seriously. You like manual. What is it about?
Because it's freeing. You know, it's nobody's there to tell you to do it. You know if you're doing something right. You know if you're cleaning a toilet or, you know, a shower or a sink or washing a dish and drying it. I mean, it's liberating. You're doing a load of laundry.
Yeah.
And it does. It's meditative.
It's funny you say that because my wife is constantly badgering me because we'll have dinner and we'll cook dinner, or even if we order food in and plate it for everybody and eat here in the city or out on Long Island where we live. And when we're done, I'll say to everybody, get out of this room. Take your wine bottles and your glasses and go in the other room. And I want to be left completely alone here to clean this kitchen. And there's a tremendous sense of
accomplishment.
Of relaxation. When it's over and the kitchen's gleaming and all the dishes are put away and everything, I feel...
There you
what
go.
Is it about people who need to occupy themselves that way?
Well,
to take your mind off things,
I think it's an escape from, you know, the intellectual.
And I go beta. I don't think so much.
Yeah.
I'm just going to relax. Yeah, it's very relaxing.
It is. It's totally... like
I'm focused on that.
it's a freeing experience.
You come back from the kibbutz and you go to L.A.
Yep, to L.A.
Lotus Weinstock, Paul Mooney. How do they influence you?
Well, they believed in me. And they thought I was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. And, you know, just thought I was adorable and fresh and crazy. And, you know, nobody had seen a 5'10", you know, 19-year-old, you know, wearing a safari jacket, safari shorts, some lace-up espadrilles, a little hat, you know, just full of, like, vim and vigor and piss and vinegar. And I was just like a wild card.
What's the first club you got? You did open mic.
This was at the Yee Little Club in Beverly Hills. They had opened mic on Monday night. It's also where Joan Rivers used to break in her new material back in the day. So I got up and I did my first joke. I'm a medium. I understand you're a small. You're an extra large. That was my first joke. And then it just kind of went on from there. And then I started incorporating my singing, you know, which was really my first love. I really wanted to be another Bette Midler. I wanted to be like a wild singing, edgy, crazy entertainer, a postmodern entertainer, which I became in my own way. I did at least a year of, you know, the Little Club or Rusty's Bagel, this guy named Rusty Blitz. He was actually had a little part in Young Frankenstein, and he had a little storefront where he had served bagels and you'd get up and do your 5 minutes. So there were lots and lots of little clubs like that. And then within a year, I started going to the Improv and the Comedy Store. And that's where, you know, I started getting my chops together. And, you know, and then I started getting, you know, I did the Richard Pryor TV show because of Paul Mooney. Yeah, he did a short-lived show on NBC. Lasted about
like?
6 episodes. Well, you know, it was sketches. I was a regular. And you can see it. It's available. People come up quite often and say, oh, wow, you're adorable. Then we did a roast. We roasted Richard. I was one of the people who roasted him. So that was like that, you know, again, you're just thrown into like this major situation. And I just, you know, you just learn how to stand on your own 2 feet, you know. It didn't really involve acting school or, you know, I never really studied anything formally. It was just all my sort of, fascination and imagination that, you know, carried me through at every different juncture.
But when you're with someone like Pryor and you're young, describe to me, is Pryor calling all the shots or was some producer, writer, director doing everything?
No, it was Bert Sugarman, I think, was the executive producer, which was, I don't know, it was just sort of like incongruous, you know, some of the people involved with it. But Paul Mooney was the head writer.
Right.
Robin Williams, it was his first big gig. It was like a lot of people that familiar faces now. And so Paul would write little parts for us or a little, you know, in the sketches. And we just did it.
And that was Pryor.
And Pryor was just like...
Supportive?
Beyond. Right. He would just stand there and like laugh at everybody. You know, he was a fish out of water. He didn't like that format at all. He didn't like being under the thumb of NBC or being censored. Mm. You know, so that's why it only lasted for 6 shows.
I can't fucking do this no more.
This is the sad news. Pryor is very bottled up. You wouldn't see much emotion from Richard Pryor. It was all done in, you know, the dressing room.
But he was very supportive of you.
Oh, yeah. And always, he loved to laugh at young, up-and-coming entertainers. Totally not threatened. No need to control. If he had a suggestion, he would whisper it to Paul. It was very subtle.
Mm-hmm. And then what happens after that?
Well, you know, I'm performing during the day. I'm doing gigs. I'm still not. Yeah.
How would you say your performances are changing?
Well, I mean, they opened a room at the Comedy Store called the Belly Room, which was for only women performers. So it was the woman who owned it, Mitzi Shore, who's still around. Barely. She was very like, she was like a segregationist. You know, she separated the men from the women and she loved the men. She didn't like the women. She didn't think women really belonged in comedy. And it was all very strange. So, but I got a lot of confidence in this Belly Room because people came to see women and they weren't expecting you to do male driven comedy. And it was just different. So it freed me up to do what I did, which was very completely post-feminist. I refused to be self-deprecating, and nobody had done that yet. No woman comedian performer hadn't done something where she was like, oh, you know, I'm so ugly, or I'm this, or
yeah,
I'm that.
And I'm single.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was really young, so it wasn't like I didn't feel like, what am I, why would I do that? You know, I'm hot.
I'm happening.
You know? Yeah, that was my attitude. And of course, I was always nervous, like everybody starting out, but I covered it up by being this sort of character, you know, this super erudite, sophisticated, groovy, swinging, you know, chick.
On top of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, all over it.
Yeah.
So that was the direction I kept going in. And I did a couple other little movies, little parts, little this. And then in 1981, I auditioned for The King of Comedy, the Robert De Niro, Jerry Lewis, Martin Scorsese vehicle, along with a lot of other people. And, you know, at that point, I was like, I didn't even think about it. I just did it. They wanted somebody who could improvise, which I did. And after like about a month or two of auditioning, several auditions at different levels, I got the part. And that was, you know, a game changer for me. And after that, I didn't have to perform at the comedy clubs anymore.
Did you miss that?
No, I didn't. I never wanted to go back to the comedy
Why?
Clubs. Because I didn't like that scene.
You didn't?
No. That wasn't for Sandy. That wasn't for Sandy. No. Then I could start, you know, playing rock and roll clubs and doing concerts. And
you like that?
Even if it's just like a rock and roll club, it has a different connotation because then I have my band and I can sing and do all the things that I do because I wanted to do a whole performance, a whole evening, not just like tell jokes.
Right. You say that Scorsese and the people involved with the film, I guess, auditioned several people for quite a while to get down to casting you. What was your interaction with him? Did he work with you a lot? Did you go in and see him a lot, work the material with him a lot?
Yeah, well, I mean, my initial audition was for Sis Corman, the casting person.
Right.
And she was like visibly stunned by me. And I didn't know what that meant, but she's like, I think Marty needs to see you.
Yeah.
So she had me back the next day. And Deborah Winger was driving a Volkswagen. And I'd known Deborah Winger because she was a waitress at the Improv, and she said, Sandy, it's me, Debbie. And I said, oh my God, hi, Debbie. So then I got nervous because I thought, well, she must be up for the film too. I'm sure she was. It was up at the Chateau Marmont. That was where all the auditions in LA were, at the Chateau. So the next day I went back and I read for Marty, and he loved it. And then he brought me back to read for him and Bobby De Niro. And yeah, they just kept, and then they came to see me perform at the Comedy Store, and Richard Belzer did a little improv with me, which was really sweet, because then they could see how I interacted, like, with somebody who was, you know, sort of like the movie was going to be, and they loved that. And then I didn't hear from anybody for a month, and then they flew me to New York, and I stayed at the Mayflower Hotel, which is now, you know, that big
15 Central Park West,
where it was all happening. The Mayflower Hotel.
Simi Biddle Barrows was her name.
Yes.
The Mayflower Madam.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know that from personal experience. I don't have her business card in my
Well, but the Mayflower attache, Hotel, a lot was happening.
The Mayflower
I can tell
Hotel,
you that
yeah.
much. I mean, every actor
they sold
stayed
the
there.
Remember that they sold the contents of the hotel. They tore down the hotel. And before they did, they offered people a chance to come in and buy the contents. They sold, like an estate auction, the drapery and the furniture.
I mean,
crazy.
It was the worst stuff in the world. I mean, it was like from, you know, from a million years ago. But it was a fun place to be. And then that was the audition where I was going to read with Jerry Lewis.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
And what was that like?
Oh, I think it was great, but that was the only time I was really nervous in the whole audition process because it was Jerry Lewis. And he's an intimidating figure.
Sure.
You know?
When I met him, he's kind of a no-nonsense guy.
Well, he's no-nonsense and he knows everything. You know, he's like the know-it-all.
But it's interesting how you, I don't consider myself a comedian, but I've done a lot of comedy programming and so forth. And I'm around these eighth degree black belt comedy people.
Right.
And some of them it's almost inconceivably dry and very droll when you meet them in person. And their own persona, a couple I'm thinking of, is very antic and very nutty and silly. And then you see them backstage and they're like, you know, you'd think that you're talking to
a politician.
Yeah, the Prime Minister of England.
Right.
And you're like on a state visit or something. And they're very proper and buttoned up and no jokes or whatever. And he strikes me that way.
Oh, he's pompous, imperious.
Right. Very imperious is what I would think.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's clear everything's been said that there is to say about Jerry Lewis up until now. I mean, he's still unbelievable. He's still that same person. And he hadn't really worked with a woman like me before. He don't, you know, he'd used people like Stella Stevens, is that her name, as sort of like, you know,
a foil.
Yeah. You know, women weren't there to actually hold their own.
They're Margaret Dumont.
Uh-huh.
And that woman from the Marx Brothers.
Yes.
The foil.
Exactly.
But when you're there with him, you know, that's Marty in and around. I mean, Raging Bullet came out a little bit before that, just a couple years before, I think in like 1980 or something. You know, that's Marty right cresting at the peak of his power.
Right.
When he's making this film with you.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, does De Niro and Marty obviously have, and I can't even define it, their own legendary kind of battery between
yes.
the two of them and how they
yes.
work and
very much
the
so.
Unspoken and the spoken and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And but I wondered, does someone like Lewis, does he defer to Scorsese?
No.
He didn't.
No, Scorsese deferred to him.
He was very self-directing.
Yeah, self-directing, but also Marty would, like, I guess, humor him in a certain way and say, well, what do you think about this scene? And so,
he had to be handled a certain way.
Yeah, so Jerry was made to feel like he was bringing his expertise.
He was the eminence.
Perfectly said.
But the scenes, and I mean, I've been in films before with people, and some of it, this dichotomy with them, I don't want to say tension, but
mm-hmm.
some of that relationship with them resulted in a really good film
yes.
or stage play.
Yes.
And sometimes it didn't.
Right.
People always say, oh, you this kind of crackle that you create, there's a magic that happens, or there's something that happens that's palpable on screen. I don't always buy that.
Yeah.
However,
yeah.
You and he, it is mesmerizing.
Thank you.
It's mesmerizing.
Yes.
You and he on screen together, I can't think of who's going to break a glass and shove the jagged edge in whose neck first.
Yes. Well, that's, you know, that was because I just stayed in the moment. And as intimidated as I was.
You didn't.
I didn't. I
back down.
I didn't relent. I held my ground, which, you know.
Was he expecting you to relent? You think, was he expecting you to kind of break down?
I think he was hoping.
Yeah.
That you know,
you'd be weaker on film than
yeah.
he wanted you to be.
Yeah.
That's, isn't that amazing?
Well, and then that kept, you know, rising the temperature, you know, for him. I was respectful and slightly in awe of Jerry Lewis.
Right.
For sure.
You're in a movie and you more than hold your own. I mean, you are right up there delivering the goods in the film with Robert De Niro.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And Jerry Lewis in this quirky, weird movie that everybody loves. I know who knows that movie and loves you in it. And the weirdness of it, you know, you and him, everybody all taped up and everything, and the way you had all that done. What happens after that? I mean, does everything just change for you dramatically?
Well, it did change for me, but at the same time, I don't know if I was savvy enough at that time to, like, things were different. I mean, now you're like, young actors are like, they're plugged in, like, they, you know, they've got their machinery all ready to go.
They got a team.
And back then it was just sort of more like, wow, I just did this great movie, but now I want to kind of just go out in the road and do my shows. And, you know, things, of course, were at a different level, you know, but looking back, had it been now, I guess I probably would have been more craven in a certain way.
Aggressive.
Yeah. But I feel like young actors are, they're just so, like, everything is just like, like I said, a machinery. Like, somebody grabs you and there's, you know, there's the publicist and then there's the agent and there's the manager and then there's the handler and then there's the, you know, and everybody's just, like, kept, you know, in a certain sort of position where they're not really free to, like, move and be, like, totally outrageous or groovy, you know?
Well, I think that there's certainly people who, in my lifetime, myself included, who, and this is a big swing here, I don't necessarily think you're going to mind agree, but I tend to think that years ago when I was first making films, and I don't mean small parts in films in the 80s, but playing lead roles in films in the 90s, you do a movie and it was over. Yes, you shared about, I want to go on the road and do my show and what have you, but I had much more faith in Providence about what was going to happen to
That's
me artistically.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean.
I kind of laid back and I go, well, I'm going to go do a play. I'm going to go do this. And I thought, well, only a fool thinks you can really manage this whole thing and make yourself successful. That's
right.
Like, that's luck. And I get a script sent to me and I would evaluate the script based on the instincts I had. And I'd
yes.
read a script and I go, I don't think this is very interesting. And my agents would call me up and go, hey, man, you need to come in here and read the script again in my office. I have a special lamp I have on my desk,
uh-huh.
and we're going to put that on the script.
Uh-huh.
And the lamp is a lamp that projects onto each page the amount of money you're going to be paid for this movie, because it's like millions of dollars. And now I feel like people have bought, so many young people have, they're making movies they don't want to make. They're making movies they don't even know if they want to make them.
Right.
But they've been sold on the idea that this is the movie they should be doing to stiffen their career.
Right. Well, also, there's so many films now that are, you know, that are the big, you know, either sci-fi or, you know, or the
Marvel.
Superhero. It's just, it's a different time. It'll never be what it was in the 80s and 90s.
Let's face it, though. You and I, we'd chop one of our hands off to be in one of these Marvel movies. You know
that. Well, I think we'd both be great. I mean, I think I'd be a great kind of evil superhero.
Yeah.
So then I did a little bit of television. I did a little bit of film. And then I did a lot of performing. And then I sort of, you know, really broke out as a live performer. I did my first one-woman show here in New York, Without You, I'm Nothing, which was legendary,
right,
and became an actual film, not like a special, but we made it into a film that was quite interesting, and you can still see it. And it was sort of like a breakthrough performance film that a lot of people try to emulate and copy because it wasn't just...
How did that come about?
Well, I was collaborating at the time with this this artist named John Boscovich. He had directed the show, the live show, and then somebody gave us the money for him to direct the movie. And Nick Rogue, who I'd done a film with called Track 29, he was the executive producer on it, and he just sat on the set and kind of oversaw, you know, the shots and everything. And we turned it into this sort of like very, very crazy commentary on performance films. It was sort of like, you know, kind of went in on itself. And nobody had ever seen anything like it. And so that kind of established me in a whole other way, too. And that, you know, that was a great stepping stone for me in terms of, like, being, you know, an iconic live performer. And that's kept me going throughout the years when other things weren't happening.
Coming up, Bernhard talks activism and empathy and why she never wanted to be the poster girl for just one cause. Explore the Here's the Thing archives, where you can hear my conversation with another iconic New York artist.
I was an attention getter, but I didn't want to be Eve Arden. I really didn't.
Okay, that's a good point. Why?
Well, because I don't want to be a funny girl that's just cracking wisecracks or staying up with the, with the rollers in her hair.
Yeah. Take a listen to Elaine Stritch at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Sandra Bernhard got her start in comedy clubs in the 1970s, but she quickly moved on to television and movies. And today, she still performs live regularly. She doesn't prefer one form over the other.
Well, I think everything feeds off of the other. I mean, you know, if you're not on television and you're not doing films, it doesn't support your live performing. You got to have a certain amount of exposure. And it's also good to mix it up and be collaborative and not always depending on your own, you know, creative source, which sometimes you need a break from that because you can't. I mean, you know, writing a show, writing material, It's a big undertaking. You can't always.
I witnessed that. Other people, I didn't do it, but when I worked with Tina, I witnessed
you
that.
Know,
it's enervating.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. I'm sure that show was. I mean, that's a whole different ball game.
Well, that was, you know, it was her producing and writing
I
and
know.
Head writing and starring.
Unbelievable.
So she was exhausted. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But great. You know, the results were great for her and for everybody. In the end, you left L.A. And when you left LA, you moved to New York? That was where you
went? For years, I just went back and forth.
Back and forth.
I kept a house out in LA in the Valley.
When you got your first home here, where in the Valley?
North Hollywood. On Blix, between Kling and Klump, off of Riverside. My little Spanish bungalow that I bought in 1986.
For like $40.
Just about.
$140,000.
Yeah.
I lived in the Valley.
Where'd you live?
I lived up above Taft High School in Woodland Hills with my ex-wife. I was there for 10 years that I was with my ex-wife, with her and married to her. And then for about 7 years, a little bit after I was divorced, I went back there and rented a house around the corner from them. So if my daughter forgot something, which was very common, she could go back home and get it.
The Valley has its...
Do you like the Valley?
I love the Valley.
You do?
Yeah.
What do you like about the Valley?
It feels like you're just somewhere else.
I like the Valley because it's just unpretentious.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's not L.A. It's not...
You drive down the boulevard and all that shitty architecture.
It's wonderful.
It's you just you become comforted.
Yeah, because you don't feel like you have to come up, you know, you don't have to rise up to anything. There is no pretense in the Valley.
Let's do our Valley. Let's Valley off right now. Where would you go? Where would you go?
Well, back then, I mean, you know, there's Jinkies.
Jinkies.
For breakfast.
Yeah.
They're mainly breakfast,
good breakfast
place.
Yeah, breakfast places.
Dinner.
CC's Pancakes,
yeah,
on the boulevard over near Encino.
Yes.
Iroha for sushi over,
yes,
there by Coldwater Canyon.
Right. Well, like New York, like any place. But New York, you can get quicker, you know, to, you know, if you want to go for Italian, there's, you know, you can go downtown, you can go uptown, you can stay midtown. I mean, there's a million places to go. But L.A., it's like, you know, it's a big schlep.
Well, as my friend Ken Page told me, the great Ken Page, who worked on Broadway forever in Cats and different shows like that, Ken Page said to me, he said, New York is a river and L.A. is a lake. He said, in New York, you step out the door and there's a current that pulls you in a certain direction. You just go, if you're walking down the street with your friend smoking a cigarette down Columbus Avenue, you're doing something.
And you'll certainly land somewhere
else. And you're
going to
end up
else
somewhere.
He, yeah,
said, and you'll land somewhere. He says, L.A., you got to put your oars in the water and row
like a son of a gun.
To where you want to go. You have to make plans.
Yes.
And it tests friendships.
Yes. So, you know, so I never really left L.A. until my daughter was, you know, 5 or 6, and it was, school became more serious. And then we stayed here most of the time.
Now, are you married?
No, I'm essentially, but, you
essentially
know, my girlfriend and I are.
She's your partner.
She's my, oh, very much so.
And she's someone who, if I read her bio correctly, she basically did one show. Did she do the show with you? Does she continue to write, or she's not writing anymore?
She writes, but she's never written. We've written scripted projects for TV, but to no avail so far.
But she worked with you, didn't she?
No.
No, okay.
No, no. I met her when she was working at Harper's Bazaar.
I thought she wrote a show on IMDb. It said she did like the Sandra Bernhardt Experience or something.
Oh no, that was my short-lived talk show on A&E, and
right,
she was on it as my sidekick. She didn't know how the hell she ended up there. She was like, if this show gets picked up, I'm not doing this anymore. She's from St. Louis. She's no nonsense. She's like, she's not in it to, you know, for the fame or the attention. She's just the opposite, which is so refreshing.
You first got your first home here when?
Well, we bought our place in 2000 in West Chelsea.
What's changed for you about New York?
Well, I mean, it's home now, for better or for worse.
But since 2000, which is 16 years ago, obviously.
Yeah.
What's changed?
Emotionally or the city?
All of it.
The city is, you know, as we all know, it's become sort of a hackneyed conversation. It's not the city we all loved in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know,
it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's lost its core, you know. It's lost its ability to welcome people who are just starting their careers. You can't afford to live here.
You know, years ago, there were pockets of communities of affordable housing which were very often utilized by artists.
Right.
And the artistic community here,
yeah,
seems to have left slowly, whether it's visual artists.
Well, everybody's left. And I mean, and you know, yeah, I guess some people moved out to Brooklyn and up
Jersey,
to Queens and New Jersey. But, you know, if you're starting out and you are like literally like a visual artist, like a painter, I think people are going all over the place. They're going to Detroit. They're going to Pittsburgh. They're going down south. I mean, you got to go someplace where there's a community, but where you can afford to live. I mean, you can't,
yeah,
you got to, if you're painting, you need space. You can't paint in like a, you know, one tiny little room and live there too.
Well, as the city has changed, and hand in hand, obviously, the people who live here has changed. And it's like, that's what I find is that New Yorkers themselves.
Yeah. Well, there's still people, you know, there's still people that, you know, had rent control. So there's still, you know, there's still a few of the old, you know, the kind of Woody Allen-esque New Yorkers,
yeah,
that you see that you think, oh, they'd be great in a Woody Allen film,
right,
you know, like the older Jewish couple or, you know, just the sort of, you know, interesting, flamboyant people that populated the city when I first used to come here, you know, and now they're...
Less of them.
Yeah. You know, and every time one of them sort of leaves or dies, you go, oh, it's, you know, We're closer and closer to being,
to extinction.
To creative extinction, you know, and it's you know, and yet I don't know. I still prefer living here than LA at this point. I love to go to LA. I like to spend time there. I guess if they called me and said you're gonna come do a TV show in LA, I'd run as fast as I could because I want to work, and I'd be fine because I have a lot of friends out there too. And there's lots of things about LA that I still love, but. I don't know. Everything's different. The world's different. We're on the precipice of total craziness.
I know.
You know, the Band-Aid's been ripped off the wound. The Republican Party, we see what people, a big swath of people in this country really feel, the racism, the fear, the xenophobia, the misogyny, on and on and on.
Oh, the mourning for a way of life in this country that's ending.
That's been ending.
American supremacy and the fact that we're going to go into other countries and interfere with their lives, and we're going to exert our military power in every corner of the world to our advantage, to our standard of living, to keep our standard of living. It isn't working anymore.
No. It's a time of flux. It's a time of change. And it's a time of, you know, in a certain way of anarchy, you know, on both sides of the aisle, and you're not sure how it's going to all shake down.
Do you write every day? Or you?
I do.
To write? You do.
Well, especially now that I have my own radio show on Sirius.
How did that come about?
Andy Cohen got his own channel. It's called Radio Andy, and he asked me if I would do a show every day, and I said, "Yeah, I'll do it," because you know I'm here in the city most of the time, or a lot of the time, and. I thought that would be fun, and it's really been great. And it's really been, you know, very, like, I've been...
You do a show every day?
Do a show 5 days a week.
Live?
Yeah, live. 12 to 1.
Now, do you find, you've been very, this is such a tired way of putting this, I don't know any other way, but you've been very supportive and very upfront of the LGBT community and your work. And do you find it's, like, are you glad you came out, but you lived your life... bisexually or whatever way at the time you did, or
yes.
Do you wish you were here now?
No.
You don't?
No, because it was never really about that for me.
You didn't care?
No, of course I care. I want rights for everybody. I want everybody who's unique to be comfortable in that setting. So that was always from my point of view, like, if you are a freak, fly your freak flag and be comfortable that you're going to be fine, because I can't always hold your hand through it, because I was of the belief when the LGBTQ thing really blew up. It was like, kids, we all have to buck up, you know? We all have to be soldiers. We all have to be warriors.
You like that you were there for the fight, so to speak.
No, because I wasn't there for the fight.
Oh.
I mean, no. I believe that the fight's an individual fight. And I'm not... This is like a whole... You know, this is a very... I'm just paring it down. Of course, I stand... in solidarity to everybody, you know, and that goes for everybody who deserves support. But what I'm saying for myself personally, I never needed that. I wasn't like, you know, validate me, accept me. I don't feel comfortable. I was always comfortable in my own skin. And I liked who I was, and I didn't define myself by my sexuality. I defined myself by my desires and my imagination and all the things that looked, you know, like a buffet. I like a buffet. I don't like one dish. So, you know, sometimes I was dating boys. Sometimes I was dating girls when I first moved to LA. And then over the years, I had relationships, but I was always just like, whatever. I was into my career. I wanted to have fun. So until I met my present girlfriend, Sarah, who's amazing. And she wouldn't take it any other way because she's, you know, she doesn't take any prisoners, and she shouldn't. But she's also like, this is how it is. The world needs, everybody needs to buck up, get tough. So I've just never been one to like, oh my God, let me hold your hand. Oh, poor baby, sweetheart. You know, it's like, and I understand some people are born into circumstances. If you're transgender or you've been thrown out of your home because you're gay, it is the worst possible thing in the world. And of course I have wells of empathy, and I've done, you know, and I will do, and I have done benefits to raise money to be there, and I'm a vocal spokesperson. But I also see people on the train. I see, you know, people of color. I see old people. I see all kinds of people who are just barely hanging on. So my empathy is like from one end of the rainbow to the next, and it's never been specifically LGBT. It's like we're all in this fucked up soup together, and everybody who doesn't have enough is suffering. So you got to spread the shit around, and you got to spread the empathy, and you got to also say to those who are a little bit like, take care of me. Like, okay, you got to take care of yourself right now. I'll circle back to you when I have time. I'm over here right now trying to help, you know, this person. Because it's just, there's too much going on.
What was it like for you being a mom and raising your daughter?
Amazing. Well, you know, also, it's a rarefied atmosphere. You know, we have help. We have people that are there. Yeah. You know, we have a support system.
People have full lives.
Yeah. Got to keep working.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But it was a leap of faith for me. I mean, it wasn't like I was like, I didn't grow up thinking, oh, I've got to have a kid. But suddenly, like when I was 40, I said, I think I just better do this because I think I'm going to regret it. And I would have regretted it. And it's a work in progress. I mean, you know, you have an older kid. And I'm sure that there are times when she still calls on you and you're like, because you want them to just...
That's what I'm going to do now. From now on, when Ireland calls me, my daughter, if you're listening, I'm going to call her after this is over. I'm going to say, Ireland, when you call, I'm going to go, I'm going to imitate you.
But sometimes, you know, well, my
it's
daughter...
It's like Ross Chast.
Yeah. Exactly. My daughter just started college, so I can't, I mean, of course, she's still a baby.
What does she want to study?
She wants to write television, she wants to write comedy.
Don't name the school, but is she going East Coast, West
East,
Coast?
East, small, sticking around. Liberal arts, great college. Cool. She got in, she did it.
That's cool.
So,
that's cool.
You know, I got no complaints.
Now, you ever thought about doing a drama, like a one-hour drama, or is that too much work? Those are long hours.
I'm ready, you know. Honey. Why, you got something in mind for me? Call me up.
I think I do, actually.
Call me. I'm ready to go to work tomorrow.
We have something that's in infancy of development.
I'm ready to go to work tomorrow. I'll work the long hours.
It'll be in New York.
Honey, hallelujah. I'll be there. I'll be there with bells on.
Speaking of being there with bells on, you are at the Sorting Room at the Wallace. It's called the Wallace.
Wallace Annenberg Performing Arts Center in Beverly Hills, December 8th, 9th, and 10th. Two shows a night. And then I'll be back here. It's called Sandra Monica Boulevard, coast to coast. I'll get back in my car, drive back to New York, Joe's Pub.
You drive?
No.
Oh.
Joe's Pub. It's the romance of it.
Yeah.
Joe's Pub, December 26th through New Year's Eve. It's my holiday tradition. Two shows a night, 12 shows, six nights. I take no prisoners. We kick ass. We have a ball. I collapse at the end. And it's a new year.
I'm going to ask my wife. Now, here's a real thing I got going on. My wife is what you would call a queer dear. She's encrusted in gay men. All her friends are gay men. So we're going to bring a whole gang of them.
Please
maybe
do.
New Year's
yes.
Eve.
Yes. Yes. Come in their jock straps.
Is that what people do? They do? Is there like a thing? Is there a thing?
No.
Oh, is that a theme?
No, there's no theme.
Okay. Oh, I thought maybe you had like a really cool. Like,
no, but I like it if some drag queens still come dressed, you know, in full regalia like they used to in the old days. To pay homage.
Maybe I'll pay homage.
I don't think I want to see you in drag.
You want to see me dressed like Vidal Sassoon, like a white cream-colored Nehru jacket?
No, that I wouldn't mind. Right. Just don't wear a wig.
Don't wear a wig. Okay.
Please, I beg of you.
No. Thank you for doing this.
What a pleasure.
Sorting Room at the Wallace Annenberg in Beverly Hills, December 8th, 9th, and 10th, and December 26th through New Year's Eve at Joe's Pub.
Yeah. Rocking, so... rolling, kicking ass.
Can't wait.
I'm still loving it. I'll see you on the set of your new show, by the way.
We're going to be playing prosecutors.
Oh, honey. Woo!
Sandra Bernhard, she'll be performing live later this year. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.